The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Cindy Fowler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Dave's Garden e-newsletter, the HGTV's Garden e-newsletter, from the Triangle Gardener magazine, and maybe from Garden Smarts by Shelley Goldblum. And we will start. We'll start with Dave's Garden e-newsletter. Hope and faith flower from the cheerful seeds of the old year to the sprouting garden of the new year's dawn. That was said by Terry Guillemets. How to Grow the Christmas Rose, Helleborus Niger, by Melody Rose. Growing the Christmas Rose, Helleborus Niger, is a great way to have a little history in your garden and have a great winter-blooming perennial at the same time. Gardeners often despair when the snow flies because they have to wait until spring for flowers. However, helleborus are winter-blooming perennials that laugh in the face of winter snows. Helleborus Niger can satisfy the need for something in bloom, and growing this perennial cures the blues in an otherwise dreary gardening season. The species name Niger means black, and the description refers to the color of the helleborus roots, which are dark or black in color. Native to Central Asia and the Balkans, the hellebore has a long and interesting history. There are a number of species. However, H. Niger is reputedly the one that blooms the earliest, known as the Christmas rose, even though in no way related to actual roses. It was the first flower to bloom after the winter solstice. Legend has it that the tears of a young girl who had no gift for the Christ child, dropped upon the snow, and the angels transformed her tears into the hellebore. Early Christians associated the flower with innocence and believed that it had the power to ward off evil spirits because of this. When the Gregorian calendar replaced the Julian calendar in 1582, the superstitious people of the British Isles refused to adopt it because hellebores no longer bloomed on Christmas Day, which was January the 6th. The Gregorian calendar pushed the date back to December 25th, nearly 2 weeks earlier. It was 1751 before they adopted the new calendar. The Romans spread the hellebore throughout their empire, and it was an important part of their herbal pharmacy. Roman physicians often prescribed hellebore to treat insanity, epilepsy, and drive out demons from the possessed. Magicians used powdered hellebore to curse farmlands, which was apparently a popular medieval practice among rival farmers. It was also an ingredient in an invisibility potion that supposedly allowed the user to walk about the countryside unseen. Hellebore also contains cardiac glycosides, which is similar to the chemical makeup of digitalis, and was used as a heart medication in the elderly. The powdered root was also compounded into snuff, since it is an irritant that would cause sneezing. Growing hellebore is a great way to add to a cottage garden with an early blooming plant, and once established, hellebores are easy plants that take care of themselves. Plant hellebores in an area where they receive dappled shade and protection from the wind. They like plenty of moisture and slightly alkaline, well-drained soil. They do not do well in boggy conditions. If your soil is too acid, add some lime. Choose their location carefully because hellebores have a long tap root and are difficult to transplant once established. The nodding flowers look best when planted on a hillside or in a raised area and are quite attractive under shrubbery and along a tree line as well. Christmas roses will multiply and naturalize well in these conditions, although odd seedlings may appear. Hellebores niger has a white or pale pink flower, although seedlings with more pink or even greenish sepals are not uncommon. Seeds sprout best when fresh and not allowed to dry. They need 3 to 6 weeks of freezing temperatures to properly germinate and take about 3 years to reach maturity. These perennials are evergreen with glossy leaves and grow between 12 to 15 inches tall. Hellebores should be spaced about a foot apart to allow for spread. Pair with early blooming spring bulbs like snowdrops, crocus, daffodils, and shrubs like flowering quince. There are other species of hellebores that will add diversity to your garden, and Helleborus orientalis is the most common. This species blooms a bit later than the Christmas rose, and with their addition, you can keep hellebores in bloom in your garden until late spring. They come in numerous colors and even doubles. Helleborus foetidus, F-O-E-T-I-D-U-S, is another popular garden plant. However, it should not be planted at eye level. The specific descriptor, foetidus, means stinking, and if sniffed closely, the fragrance does remind one of a skunk. Don't let that dissuade you, though. Planted in the garden, the scent is hardly noticeable. Their garden requirements are the same. Once established, they are tough little plants that multiply and reseed with lovely variations. Pair the later blooming species with tulips, narcissus, and lilacs. The Christmas rose and its relatives are a wonderful addition to a perennial garden that needs some winter interest. Their early blooms reaffirm the truth that spring will come again. Hellebores bloom during the darkest days of the year and brighten up the season. There are a number of vendors that offer the plants by mail order, and they will be more than happy to ship them as soon as the weather warms a bit. Plant hellebores this spring for their cheerful blooms next winter. And now, HGTV's Garden E-Newsletter. Historic Houseplants for Trendy Indoor Gardens by Lynn Coulter. Victorian-era houseplants are back and better than ever. Abutilon, yellow finch, flowering maple. Once the rage in Victoria homes, flowering maples are back in style. They're lovely in hanging baskets or other containers that show off their dangling, bell-shaped flowers. Most gardeners keep their plants outside in warm weather and overwinter them indoors. They need a bright exposure in your home and should be allowed to dry out slightly between waterings. Prune lightly to keep them compact, but do not remove too many stems or the plants won't set buds. Yellow finch has crinkly yellow flowers and prefers full shade. Majesty palm, this is it. The palm used to decorate Victorian parlors. Majesty palms are still valued as relatively slow-growing, easy-care houseplants. They thrive in medium to bright light and can vacation outside in warm weather as long as they are not in the hot sun. Early gardeners admired this palm for its exotic look, and it still adds a tropical feel to most rooms. Keep its potting soil moist but not soggy. Primula, primrose. Most gardeners buy primroses in bloom and toss them after the flowers fade. The Victorians grew primroses in greenhouses and conservatories to provide the humidity and slightly moist soil the plants require. For best results, grow your primroses in a cool room. It's hard to coax them back into bloom, but if you want to try, move your plant outside when the weather is reliably warm. Bring it back in before frost, let it go dormant for a month and cross your fingers, or just buy new plants to enjoy. Sweet 16 is a large flowered variety with white and pink flowers. Maidenhair fern. Delicate-looking maidenhair ferns, like so many plants from the Victorian era, love high humidity, so early gardeners grew them in Wardian cases, terrarium-like structures made of glass. To keep your fern happy, mist it daily. Keep it in a room with high humidity, such as a bathroom or kitchen, or run a small humidifier nearby. These feathery beauties need moist, well-draining soil and indirect sun. Do not let them dry out or stand in drafts. Streptocarpus. Streptocarpuses like the same basic growing conditions as their relatives, African violets. We're luckier than early British gardeners who first grew them after a collector introduced them from South Africa. Modern varieties bloom more abundantly and in a wider range of colors. Streps, like an eastern-facing exposure when grown indoors. Let them dry slightly between waterings and keep them in a room that stays around 70 degrees Fahrenheit during the day with a 10-degree drop at night. Kimberley queen fern, also called sward ferns, Kimberley queen ferns make elegant specimen plants thanks to their straight, upright fronds. These nearly carefree natives of Australia are happy indoors if they're kept in medium light. Gardeners love these houseplants because they help purify the air, but you can also enjoy them outdoors in warm weather months. They're hardy in USDA zones 9 through 11. Cast iron plant. Cast iron plants have gone in and out of fashion since Victorian times, but these leafy beauties, which are almost as tough as their names, are trending again because they're so undemanding. They can take the low humidity in most homes, and they're forgiving if you let the top inch or two of soil dry out before you remember to water. They tolerate almost any kind of light, except complete darkness or direct sun. Lemon button fern. Crush the leaves of a lemon button fern to release their citrusy scent. These are the smallest of the Balton ferns and fun to grow as houseplants or in terrariums. Give them filtered shade. They cannot take direct hot sun. If your home is dry, mist your fern regularly or group it with other houseplants to raise the humidity in the area. Clivia houseplant. Clivias are not as widely grown as they were in Victorian times, 19th and 20th century. Gardeners in England and Belgium loved them, but they should be. Buy your plant in bloom if possible. Otherwise, it can take 2 to 5 years to form its first flowers, which typically appear in February or March. To get your clivia to rebloom, let it rest in a cool spot for about a month in a room with temperatures that range from 40 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit during the day and no lower than 35 degrees Fahrenheit at night. Do not water during this time. Then gradually resume watering and start fertilizing as you slowly increase the temperature in the room. This will encourage buds to set. Once only wealthy gardeners grew clivias, some are still expensive. Meyer, lemon tree. Imagine growing a lemon tree by the biggest, brightest window in your Victorian home and harvesting the fruits to make lemonade for your guests. Once again, Meyer lemons are the choice of many indoor gardeners. Pretty in pots, the trees like full sun, potting soil that drains easily, and regular feedings with a citrus tree fertilizer. Keep them pruned to control their size. Once the nighttime temperatures stay above 50 degrees Fahrenheit, you can take your tree outdoors for the summer. Enjoy the fragrant blooms, but keep some bottled lemonade on hand for a while. The lemons, which are sweeter than most varieties, can take up to a year to ripen. Now from the Triangle Gardener magazine, Plant Focus, Growing Daphne by Mark Wethington. Few plants can bring as much rapturous praise one day followed by angry cursing the next than winter Daphne. The intensely citrus-scented midwinter flowers draw people and pollinators out into the garden in search of the source of that heavenly fragrance. The scientific name comes from Daphne, the nymph Apollo chased in mythology, and means laurel in Greek, while odora means fragrant. In Korea, it is known poetically as the plant with a thousand-mile scent. Winter Daphne has been cultivated in Asia for centuries and is found throughout much of central and southern China. It forms a dense, tidy mound of evergreen foliage, which never needs pruning to maintain its shape. It typically tops out at about 3 to 4 feet tall and slightly wider with glossy, deep, black-green foliage. In midwinter, pink buds open to reveal pale pink-white flowers whose fragrance wafts about the garden. Pure white-flowered forms, as well as several with white or yellow variegated leaf margins, can be found in the trade. Unfortunately, Daphne tends to be short-lived in cultivation, typically surviving only 5 to 8 years in areas with hot, humid summers. Unlike many plants, which slowly look worse and worse, Daphne at least has the good grace to die quickly rather than linger. Daphne's sudden death syndrome, as it is often dubbed, is due to various root rot fungi which occurs in our soils. Combating Daphne's sudden death is best accomplished by planting in a very well-drained spot with some shade and disturbing the roots as little as possible. I find my greatest success when planting them in the dry shade under oaks and other large deciduous trees. Even with ideal siting and care, expect your Daphne to go to the compost pile in the sky in about 8 years or so. This limited lifespan turns off some gardeners, but I think 5 to 8 years of an exceptional plant is well worth the investment. When covering roses for the winter, mound each rose with 8 inches of peat moss. Do not put rose cones on till the weather has been down to 20 degrees for at least a week. This protects the roses from becoming moldy, which might happen if you cover them too soon, says Kansas City, Missouri native Ruth Coombs. Roses can flourish even in cold climates if you give them a little extra care. Unfortunately, advice about mounding and trenching, mulching and covering, pruning and not pruning is sometimes contradictory and often confusing. Two highly respected horticulturalists, Dr. Ernie Hartman and nurseryman Randy Bayer, offer a few simple guidelines for cold weather roses. Randy Bayer owns Bayer's Nursery in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Over the years, he's often been my plant psychiatrist. Ernie Hartman has been a landscape contractor, forester, park superintendent, and landscaper, and is now an associate professor of parks and recreation at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. In heavy winds, long canes will rock and gouge each other, so it is best to do some pre-winter cutting early in November. When pruning, look at each individual plant's health before coming to a decision. If the plant is spindly, cut back more. If the canes are big, heavy, and healthy, do not cut as severely. The beautiful roses in today's gardens generally are exotic hybrid roses grafted to the sturdy stock of wild rose root systems. If the bud union at the crown dies back in cold weather, the plant reverts to the wild rose with puny, leggy suckers. To protect that bud union, wait until the frost is 2 to 4 inches deep in the soil, and then mound 8 to 10 inches of soil over the crown. Air can seep in between clods of frozen earth and freeze the bud graft. So while the weather is still warm, get a pile of dirt and cover it with a tarp to protect it from rain, frost, and snow. Then when you're ready to mound your roses, you'll have loose soil on hand. Wait until you've had a few good frosts before mulching. By then, field mice have found a home elsewhere and will not nest in the mulch. Also, the air temperature is colder, so mold will not develop. Light frosts are actually good for roses because they toughen the twigs and make them hardier. Cover the dirt mounds with hay or straw mulch or with styrofoam cones to protect the mounds from the freezing and thawing action of temperature fluctuation. This also protects the canes from cold and from the drying action of the wind. To keep the cones from blowing away, anchor them by piling dirt snugly around the bottom 6 inches of the base and place bricks on the corners that face the prevailing winds. Poke a few holes in the cones to let in air. Otherwise, the warm, protected environment will become an ideal breeding ground for fungus. Do you get spring fever? If you use winter mulch, do not rush out at the sight of the first robin and exposure roses. The risk of more hard frost is not yet over. When it is safe to remove mulch from roses? When is it safe to remove mulch from roses? It's always a bit of a gamble, admits Randy Bayer. You develop a feel after a few years. The safest thing to do is to remove it gradually. First, fluff up the mulch so air flows. Later, remove the mulch. Finally, remove the soil mound just when the buds start to swell. If you opt for cones in the spring when the ground is still frozen but the sun starts warming the cones, start checking inside each cone twice a week, suggests Ernie Hartman. If the canes are starting to show life with any new green growth, they will need sunlight to live, and it's time to remove the cones before mildew and fungus build up. Propagating. For multiplying climbing roses, try this simple method from an old family garden almanac belonging to Cherry Hemker of Onalaska, Wisconsin. Bend down the cane that you wish to propagate. Make a deep cut in the branch on the underside to stimulate root growth. Press the cut section into the ground, cover it with soil, and place a rock on either side of the wound to hold it down. Virtually all roses sold today are fancy tops grafted onto the roots of sturdier but less showy varieties. The time-tested technique of rooting canes is fine for multiplying wild roses or any non-grafted ones, but do not try this with grafted ones, cautions Sam Berger of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. If you do, the new canes will inherit the traits of the grafted canes and will very likely lack the hardiness of the rootstock, says Sam. Are you looking for roses that are disease-resistant and winter-hardy with a long flowering season? A new series of landscape roses are now being developed by the nursery industry, says Gary Kohler, managing horticulturist for Harvard University's Arnold Arboretum in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Cultivars that Gary likes are Bonica, Carefree Beauty, Sea Foam, Chuckles, Europeana, Europeana, and Iceberg. Though some of these new roses may be less fragrant and less showy, they are tougher, more adaptable, and more trouble-free than the hybrid tea roses, Gary says. The Frau Dagmar Hastrup Rugosa is a lovely, fragrant, single-petal pink rose. It blooms profusely in June, then intermittently thereafter. It grows to a height of 3 feet with good foliage. Another Rugosa beauty is Blank Double Découverte, C-O-U-B-E-R-T, which grows to a height of about 6 feet in a tall, rather symmetrical mound. Its pure white double blossoms have a clean, almost penetrating fragrance. The hundred-leaved centifolia cabbage rose and the pink or striped Gallico shrub roses are other fine varieties that once graced farm homes long ago and are well worth a place in our gardens today. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Cindy Fowler, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This podcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time.